My name is Sam Zwingli, and I will be the primary interview today. It's February 13th, 2015.
My name is Cole Mankey. I'll be helping her out.
My name is Jonathan Abels, and yeah.
So, tell me how you came to join the Army.
Well, my grandpa was in the Air Force, the Air National Guard, and so I kind of wanted to join something, and then my roommate at the time, who was about to be my brother-in-law, he was in the infantry, in the Army infantry, so I wanted to join the Army, is what he told me to do, and then he said, if you're going to do anything, you better go infantry, or you better not join at all. And I was like, really? And he said, yeah, if you're not going to, you know, be infantry, he's like, you might as well just, like, go join the chair force or something. So I said, all right. He's like, I can't mess with the Marines because they do their job. So.
Do you remember walking to the recruiting office?
Yep.
And what was it like?
I walked in and there was a guy who knew my knew Mike at the time, and he was like
Mike Eshtay?
No, Mike, my brother-in-law at the time. Yeah, Michael Collins. But yeah, he walked in with him, and it was the same guy who like not recruited him, but he knew him somehow. And so they're like, they knew each other, and small world.
Did you ever have any conflict about going straight into the Army? Like, did you consider being part of what your brother-in-law called the chair force or the Air Force?
I considered being part of it to do like a PSYOPs thing for like a very short period of time, but they weren't pursuing having me join as the Army. I mean, they came to my house multiple times to give me a sign.
Uh-huh.
They wanted that signature, so it was easier to go with them.
Did you ever think about going to the Marines, or is it just Army all the way?
I didn't. The Marines were never really kind of, I was like, I thought about it, and the way I had described to me is, somebody said it, they had different ways, and one guy described to me, he's like, if you want to be walking, and maybe even think about taking a puff off a cigarette, you'll be all right. But in the Marines, you better be walking somewhere with a purpose, and you can't be doing anything while you're like, he's like, you'll get yelled at and all this stuff. And so it just seemed like a lot more discipline in the Marines.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
So you have a family of, well, you're part of a family with 9 kids. How did your parents and your siblings react to your decision to enlist?
They were really happy about it. My dad and I talked about schooling, and he said he could pay for some classes, but he couldn't really afford to pay for the whole schooling. So he said, you want to get a job at this one company downtown? And I was like, no, I don't really want to work there anymore. So I joined the Army. So.
And where were you living at this time?
At that time, I was living at my brother's house. It was like a transition into the real world. I didn't really have to pay full rent. And it was still my brother, so he wouldn't ever kick me out.
Yeah.
And I lived there for a while. And then I went and signed up for the Army. And they said, like, 6 months enlistment. And then a couple weeks later, I said, can you do any quicker? And they said, 21 days, we can get you to basic. So I was like, sure, let's do it.
And was this in Texas?
Yep. Okay. Austin, Texas.
Do you think that being in Texas has a certain culture that fosters going into the military?
I think it's encouraged.
Yeah? Like, strongly encouraged? How so?
Yeah. It's one of the best things you can do, join the Army, you know, or join the military, serve your country.
Mm-hmm. How was that talked about for the youth? Like, when you were in high school, did you have Army men coming to your house or coming to your high school or anything?
No. I went to a private school, and we didn't have any Army guys coming to talk to us, really. I don't think Army guys ever came into my school, really. Maybe. I can't remember any Army guys coming to talk.
Interesting. So it was just more of like a culture that you just grew up around?
Yeah, and there's a lot of Army guys at church, a lot of Army guys in my family, and My great-grandfather, Jonathan, was in the Army in World War II. He was an E-5 sergeant, and I actually still have his tomato seeds. I grow them every year, the Jonathan tomato seeds. My name's Jonathan, so still got them.
Carrying on that legacy. How'd your siblings feel?
How'd they feel?
Yeah.
Are they
happy, scared, excited?
They were happy, yeah. Good to go.
So tell me about what happened. What was the process after you decided to enlist? So they said that they could put you in 21 days. That's really, really fast. What did you do the day you left?
The day I left, I went to MEPS and had a good time at MEPS and left. Went to basic, yeah. I don't know.
Tell tell me about Basic.
Basic was fun. We pulled up and
it was fun. That's not usually the word.
We pull up and all of a sudden just yelling and banging on the side of the bus, just like, you have 10 seconds to get off my bus. Not the bus, my bus. And I'm just like, oh no, I'm in their world now. And it's cool, like 10 seconds, you can't do that. It's not possible to get a bus full of people off. So they're setting up to fail from the get-go. We get out there yelling at us. And they're just trying to mess with us. This isn't even like the real base train. This is just like 30th AG. Like we're getting ready to go into it. And just that, like, people were freaking out. And so they, like, so that stops. You know, they walk us in, they sit us down, and they start telling us how they're going to search our bags, how they got dogs, start putting the fear of God. If you got anything, there's amnesty box. So all these guys are going up and throwing away.
What do they expect people to have?
Oh, people brought all sorts of stuff in there. Like, people were throwing stuff away, so they obviously weren't supposed to have it. They ended up not searching us at all.
Awesome.
They made us go into this one room, and the guy in the room, he was like, if you got anything cool, I'll take it, you know, but you don't have to give it to me. And that was the search.
That was it?
But they scared enough people that, like, they had, like, maybe a third of the guys go throw, like, either magazines or, like, tobacco or chewed away, and went through it away, or alcohol, they went through it away.
They brought their alcohol to Basic?
Oh, yeah.
What year was this?
04.
So you enlisted in 04? Was it
And what was this camp called?
Fort Benning.
Fort
Benning, Georgia, yeah. Home of the infantry.
I thought you said it was in Texas.
No, I enlisted in Texas.
In what year?
And then they flew me up or drove. I don't even remember how I got there. I just remember I got there quick. They put me on a plane and I was there.
You're from Texas?
Yeah, I'm from Texas.
Oh. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so they made you guys throw out everything you weren't supposed to have.
Yep.
Scared you a little bit.
Scared us a little bit. And then the best part came, haircut.
Why was that the best?
That's when you lose who you think you are. Because, like, everybody's hair, like, some guys have long hair and they think they're, like, you know, a long-haired music person. And some people have short hair and they're, like, real tough. And a lot of people have different haircuts. And when they cut everybody's and everybody looks the same, and you look and there's, like, 50, all the same dudes. The only thing is you're a little tanner than me or you're darker than me. And I'm like, or you're like, okay. Or he's bigger or smaller. Like, there's no difference. Everybody looks the same.
Do you think that promoted, like, team cohesion at all?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think it made everybody more uniform and together. Nobody was different anymore. It was all just gone.
Tell me about the guys there.
We had some of the crazy, like, we had this one tall, we had a tall kid from Oregon. And I'll never forget this because I had such a bad, you don't have to write this one, but there's this, he was a meth head from Oregon, no teeth.
Oh.
And he's like, I'm just here to get me a new set of teeth and I'm going to get out. And he was like 6, he was kind of like Lurch or something. He was like 6'8", 6'9". Couldn't even do a push up. Just there to get some dental. Oh, he was out in the first 10 weeks after he got his teeth fixed. He was gone. Teeth fixed, bunch of Oxycontin, he was out.
Really?
Yeah, that was it.
How does that work? I thought that when you sign up, you have to stay. At least we were talking to a Marine that said they keep you on. Like,
oh, no. I had a kid, Bennett, Bennett, made Bennett. He was for some reason they didn't put I was with this. They put me, this kid Bennett, as battle buddies, but they didn't put me and Chief together. Chief's this big 6'6" Indian dude in Basic, who was legit. He was an Indian. He could track. Like he was like he was from like Washington.
So he's a Native American.
Native American. A Chief. Yeah, his name's Chief. Yeah. He's Indian. Anyway.
So it's a bunch of different guys.
Yeah. And, and so, like, he ended up being my battle buddy later on, and him and I were, like, pretty much unstoppable together. It was great.
What's a battle buddy?
It's your guy, everything they assign you, you have to have a battle buddy. You can't be alone, and so you have to be with him. You got to go to the bathroom. He's supposed to be there and know where you are, watch your rifle, do stuff with you. Like, if you have to do a heavy job, you always grab your battle buddy. So.
Is this out in combat situations too, or just the base?
Yeah, they teach it too in the beginning, and then everybody becomes your battle buddy after a while. It just starts to spread, and everybody's your battle buddy.
As time went on, were you regretting joining, or were you happy that you did join?
It started to make me embrace more. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I loved it. It was good.
My dad's described boot camp as being like a big game.
Such a mental game. It's like my buddy told me, he's like, this is reindeer games. They're going to try to get in here, but don't let them. He's like, let them get right here. Let them think they're in there. But always have that core self. And like, my church prayed for me. I went in front of a church, probably the biggest solid rock. Well, I'd say bigger, probably like five times the size of solid rock.
And solid rock.
And they prayed in front of me. Or not prayed in front of me, prayed for me. Yeah, like down in front of the church, they brought me down, everybody prayed over me, and I went to basic. But yeah, and when I was there, like, people tried to mess with me a little bit, but out of the whole company I was in, I was picked to be promoted in basic training from E1 to E2 because I was high speed. I was just kind of in the middle, quiet, had glasses on for the first, like, 6 weeks, and then I took them off. And they were like, hey, wait a second, where'd you come from? But it was funny, because with the glasses on, like, I just snuck right through basic. And
Do you have any specific, like, boot camp instructors or, like, sergeants that you remember particularly?
Drill Sergeant Ulam, he had a short Napoleon complex. He'd always step on in front of boxes. Anything around, he would step on. There could be, like, a 3-inch stool, he'd get it, just so he'd be a little bit taller. And then there was Drill Sergeant Perez, he was the head guy. He looked like Yosemite Sam from Texas, but he was a Hispanic dude from Texas. And he drank nothing. He would just drink Cavarsier and come to work. And just flip his head up like he's got 2 6-shooters. Then just start barking orders. Get out and get out. Make the room sweat. He's just coming in drunk and like.
Did you guys, I have to ask this, did you guys have stress guards?
Oh, no. No, we had kids get kicked in the chest, knocked out. We had people, we would have our lockers thrown out the windows and broken, and our fault. Like, we were told to police our own unit. Like, I mean, there was kids' heads that would go through shower stalls, or, like, bathroom. You know the bathroom stalls where, the seated things are?
Yes.
Those have been broken with kids' faces many times in my platoon. Many times. So the big guys that the first name of the alphabet are and the last name, because they're the front door and the back door.
Do you, while we're talking about it, for the head, do you guys have doors on your stalls?
Yeah. And
or no doors?
No
doors.
No, we had doors. We did.
Man, it's awkward when you're trying to take a crap. Oh.
No, we had
that. Looking at the
I think
guy,
we had doors, I'm pretty sure.
Locking eyes.
We didn't have, yeah.
Oh my god.
That's how you bring people together.
just hanging on, like, hold on, buddy.
You share magazines and stuff? I mean, it's calmer. Well, we didn't have magazines, but letters. But focus on you.
So, did you make a lot of friendships during basic?
A couple. I haven't talked to a single. While I was in basic, and Drill Sergeant Spaulding was the best one. He was this dude who was a good Christian guy, really tough at basic. But I met him afterwards at the mall with my family, and he was legit. But I met a kid in basic who was a ranger, just got out of ranger school. We went to church together in my high school. And he actually saw me. He's like, hey, Bulls, come here. And I saw him walk through, like, Anthony. And I was like, no way, I know that kid. And then the drill sergeant said, hey, Bulls, you're in trouble. Get over here. Mountain climbers, go. And I'm like, oh, crap. So I'm thinking I'm in trouble. So I just run into his office, start doing mountain climbers. And then he shuts the door and says, get up. All right, now you and this kid go out, talk. Don't worry about standing in it, parade, rest. He's like, relax, talk to the guy. And so we went out there and talked for like about an hour. So he was my friend from high school.
Did any of the guys get homesick?
Yeah, probably. A lot of kids ran. Not ran, but like. So the platoon next to us was sending PX runs every night.
What's that?
They were doing bootleg haircuts, like all. I mean, they were just running all sorts of PX runs. Is at night you're not supposed to leave your room. You're like locked out. They would take one kid, throw him out the window or out the fire exit, because you couldn't go out the door really. So you have to go out the window. They were on the second floor, so they could jump down. And he would take a duffel bag and go fill it up with tobacco, booze, cigarettes, everything for the night, just for that night, and then everything would be gone by the next morning. And that's how people would be like he would have in their canteens, they'd have like a little bit of whiskey and some water, and they'd be walking around just drinking, you know, other canteens, and that's how my unit got
acquainted.
Yeah, but there's four different platoons, and that one was that they were bringing in all the contraband in basic.
Did you guys end up getting caught?
We got caught one time and had one of our passes revoked for it was like a 12-hour day pass. It was just on post, but off from leaving the barracks. I have to go to the bowling alley, get some ice cream just to leave.
Is this during boot camp?
Yeah, during boot camp.
You seem shocked.
Yeah.
We never had days off.
Well, after the first, 16 weeks or whatever, then you have your 9-week AIT, which is your infantry training. And towards the end of that, we started getting, we got to another, 4 or 5 days where we had, 12-hour days after we've, done everything, cleaned our weapons, cleaned our boots. We're the best platoon out of the company. We'd be like, all right, you got 12 hours, come back, go eat ice cream. And when people just go eat so much food, they would literally get sick, eat hot dogs. I mean, they would just go to town because they have,
So this is not during basic, this is...
No, this is like AIT, yeah.
Okay, that's... So it's all mixed
all the
to
same
one?
Unit, same company, same barracks room, same platoon leaders and everything, all the way through.
Oh, wow.
That way it's just real structured.
Okay.
Do you think that your experience in boot camp was really different than any other
it
branch?
Is. Yeah, I think the leather army is a lot different than the suede army.
What does that mean?
Leather boots compared to suede boots. Back when you used to have to polish your boots,
okay.
Iron your uniforms, really work hard to be a truly clean soldier. All that little stuff in the barracks teaches you to be that much more precise out in the field. Now you don't have to do any of that stuff. And I feel that a lot of that's lost, a lot of the little hard work things of making spit shine, cleaning everything down has lost. And now with cell phones in the military, it's just all gone out the window.
How do they regulate cell phone usage?
In our unit, you can't have a cell phone on, or if it's seen, you can't pull it out unless we're on cigarette breaks. It's the only time a phone can come out is on a cigarette break. Everybody smokes in the unit.
Everyone?
And this is for AIT.
In AIT, you can't have any phones. They lock all our phones. But in my unit I went to, you could have phones. But in AIT, you can't have a single... all our phones, watches, pictures, everything was locked up. The only thing we had is I had a watch because I was the very first number of the alphabet, and the last guy had a watch because he was the Z. And that was it. And it's like a full unit. We know the time, but nobody else does. You're in a no zone, no time, you're just doing stuff. Sleep when you're told, pee when you can.
So when you went to AIT, you had a lot more freedom in terms of going places, but you weren't allowed to have any outside communication?
Yeah,
I
mean, there's phones downstairs you can use.
Yeah. No
pay phones. No, yeah. When I was in, there was no cell phones, nothing like that. You weren't allowed to.
So what did you do after AIT?
After AIT, I went from there to Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
And what was your rank at this point?
I was an E2.
Okay.
Because I got promoted to basic training because they picked one guy out of my platoon, and they picked me to go E2, which I made an extra $150. It was nice.
What is an E2?
Private second class. So there's a private, then private second class, then private first class is the E3. And then E4 is a specialist. I got out as a specialist.
What's the difference between a specialist and a corporal?
A corporal is a leadership position that you're about to become a sergeant and you're in the process of paperwork's already been submitted, but they want to make you take on the responsibility but not pay you yet to see how well you'll do in the responsibility position. So if you just want to be that little spec for mafia like I was, just slide right through everywhere and nobody will tell you what to do because you're special. So you're not a sergeant, so you can't be told hey, grab those guys. So that they might say, can you come with us? Would you mind? But it's a lot different as an E4. You don't get yelled at because you've been around for at least a year and a half. And you've probably been to combat. So a lot of times nobody's going to tell a specialist what to do. And so, yeah, I like being a specialist.
How in the Army, how does rank, is it to be respected, or do you just go up to random guys what's up, man?
No, rank's totally respected. It's so respected. If I'm an E3, still a private first class, and an E1 comes to the unit and he's 40 years old and I'm 19, I can tell him to do not push-ups, but I can tell him what to do. And if he has a problem with that, I'll just get a corporal to come over and make him do push-ups to my friend who's 21 years old. Like, that's how much that, like, rank matters. Age doesn't matter. It's about rank, time and service, and what you know. It's not about, like, what you've done in the past. They want to know, like, what you know about the military. If you don't know that...
Sorry. So, in E2, can boss around an E1?
No, an E3 or an E4 can boss around an E1, for sure. But an E2, that's still, you know.
So, what point did you become an E4?
After Iraq.
So you went from Georgia to Kentucky.
Yep.
What did you do in Kentucky?
In Kentucky, as soon as I got there, we started doing mount training, which is a...
Mountain training?
Mount.
Mount, okay.
And mount, it's like a modern urban warfare training or something. Modernized urban war training, and it's like mount, M-U-T, or M-U, whatever. Clearing houses, kicking doors, and shooting balloons.
Interesting. So they were preparing you to go to Iraq.
Yeah, you start shooting balloons, and the balloons don't look like... So you start shooting balloons, but they're colorful balloons with towels. Anyways.
Did they give you
any... I don't want that in the towels part. Yeah, I don't need to put that in there.
Did they give you any training on how to deal with insurgents?
Yeah.
I missed something. What did I miss?
Yeah, they didn't give us training on how to deal with any threat that the U.S. is dealing with. Yeah, like, they gave us insurgents. We actually went down to this place called, in Louisiana. It's one of the biggest, it's not the sandbox in California. In Louisiana, there's a Fort Polk, Louisiana, there's a base, and they sent people called down there JRTC or JRTC, and it's a Joint Readiness Training Center. And what they do is they send all the people down there, and it's a desert, swampy, sandy, hot, kind of like Iraq. And so we go down there and we train, and there's Filipinos that speak Arabic. And so we go down and actually interact with Filipinos. Like, they're dressed in full garb, AK-47s, towels wrapped around their heads, speaking Arabic to us. And we have to go disarm them, treat them like, yeah, and that's how they train people. They send them to these big joint readiness places, and they train them on whatever they're going to go do.
And are these army men that you're practicing disarming?
Contractors, government contractors that we got from the Philippines when we kind of helped out. We pulled a lot of people from the Philippines, like almost all the chow halls are like a lot of, yeah, Filipino contractors.
Interesting.
And so they are over there, and they're in Louisiana, and what they would do is they would fight us, they would do hand-to-hand combat stuff sometimes, just like light, just to kind of get us going. And make sure we knew our job, and that we weren't hurting them, and we were trying to handle them correctly, and like how to properly do handcuffs if you are going to do them, and when to do them. They just did all this, all the tactical, politically correct stuff, how to deal with insurgents and the regular Iraqi people, because not everybody's an insurgent. A lot of times it's just family that you want to have tea with, and they'll tell you, like, somebody, you know, killed my uncle or my cousin, they chopped his head off, blah, 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 and then they'll tell you about it. And just, so you have to learn how to deal with people normally. And that's a lot of time we'd have tea with somebody who you don't know. Could they be the person that shot at you the next day or not? Like, it's kind of a weird environment.
Yeah. So what did you do after Kentucky or Louisiana?
After Louisiana, we came back and then went to Iraq.
How were you selected for deployment?
I don't know how that works. They just said, it was so weird, like the 2 months up to go, we're going to go. Oh, no, we're not going to go. Hey, we're about to leave. No, we're not going to leave. It'd be like, wheels up, wheels down, wheels up, wheels down. Like, everybody, like, get ready to go. Can't tell your families anything. No contact with them for 72 hours. Okay, now you can go talk to them. All right, we're not going to leave yet. And they did that, like, 5 or 6 times just to make sure. And then finally, when we were ready to go, nobody knew it. And then all of a sudden, it was like, we're leaving tomorrow.
So there was a 72-hour wait limit that they put on you. Did you contact your families once they informed you that you could be leaving?
They were doing a lot of things like that before we went. Yeah, oh yeah. They're not going to go without, like, let's say one leader, like, goes out and drinks the night before and gets arrested. Guess what? He won't be held in that jail. He will go on deployment. Like, things like that. Like, they don't want that to happen. So they get people all on the same base, and they say, you can't leave the base. They're like, get in the barracks and sleep with the Joes. And they do that, like, they just, because they know that some, even just like some of the lower end, like NCOs, they keep them on base about that time because they don't want them causing a ruckus out on town, getting ready to leave.
Were you excited to learn that you were going to leave for Iraq?
I broke up with my fiance and I told her, I didn't tell her why, but I felt like I knew I was going to either die or get injured. I just knew it. And I was like, I told my dad, I'm going to I'm gonna get so messed up over there. I was like, it's cool. And I was like, and we had code words, like we could talk on the phone. My dad and I, we talked on the phone while I was there. Code words like how I was doing, so I didn't sound like, you know. Yeah. Anyways, mm-hmm. It was cool. It was nice.
So how did you think? Well, you were explaining this to me earlier. How did you know that you were going to get hurt?
I just felt it. It was like I don't know if I had a dream or what it was, but I didn't write down why. I should have wrote down what it was, but I had this like intense feeling that I was going to either get shot or blown up or like really messed up. And so, and yeah.
By this time, what year is it?
05. I've been in for about a year, and we're about to deploy. I mean, it's July. We're deploying in a week, and right when we get over there, like I get ready to go. You know, like when you get ready for Iraq, you're like thinking, oh, do you carry a lot of stuff? You do. You have a 70-pound vest that has your plates and your ammo, a helmet that weighs like 10 pounds, a gun, a backpack. By the end of it, you're walking around Iraq at a 235-pound man. Regularly without clothes on, but with clothes on you're like no problem 300 325 walking around, you know, 10 kilometers plus a day, like, yeah.
Interesting. In terms of like physical ability, did you notice that there was an equal proportionate to like the number of women in the army, was there like an equal amount of women that were sent over to Iraq?
I have a really funny story about women in the army. So there's the infantry side of the base,
yeah.
And there's the non-infantry side of the base. And we were running down the middle of it one time, and our platoon sergeant's getting us ready for combat, and this kid's falling out of the run. So he starts yelling at the kid, and, you know, motivating him with choice verbal combos. Really motivational. I mean, he's digging deep. And this officer lady, she says, you can't yell at him like that. You're going to hurt him. He's not going to recover. And he says, lady, we're going to Iraq in less than a month. Get the heck out of my way. These are my men. I don't want them to die. I will not put the, said about the death on his hands. And he said something about that. He's like, get the heck out of my army. And told the lady to get out of his army because like she was trying to like coddle this kid.
Was she like a commanding officer? Or
oh, yeah. She was like a full-bird colonel, and he was an E6 telling her to get out of the way.
Interesting. So is there a prominent feeling that like women should be?
When I was in the infantry, I'm just going to be honest about you. Like, I don't really want you to write this part about like too much about it. But, yeah, like we were told not to listen to females. Like, if they tell you to do something, unless they're a full-bird or above, walk away. Like, we were told, like, just go to a commanding officer and you shouldn't be talking to them anyways because you're off mission. Like, you shouldn't ever talk. Like, that's what they tell, like, infantry guys. You won't interact with them unless you're on your off time. Like, because if you're doing that, you're in the wrong place.
And this is women in the army.
Yeah, like, I never interacted with them, ever. Like, I never interacted with women in the army except in a holding company once.
Did you, when you were in combat, did you ever interact? Were there ever female soldiers that were with you? Never.
Yeah. It would distract me so bad.
Really?
Oh my goodness. Okay, like when there's just a girl in the room, it distracts. Like, it just changed the entire, like, everybody's focused on the mission of getting the job done, then there's a female, and everybody's like, ooh, and then there's that mission. And it just throws off the whole game of getting the mission done. At least for combat stuff. There's a lot of other jobs that you can do that, but when it comes down to combat stuff, I think that's how I feel.
Well,
that was probably really sexist sounding.
It's not sexist. It's kind of.
It's really interesting to hear because we have a female Marine in one of our classes, and she's very gung ho about being a female Marine. But she interviewed someone that was not a big believer in.
I have a really good friend who's a female Marine. She's a truck driver, hardcore, real bad PTSD.
Yeah.
And I don't think that she should have been put in those situations. Yeah. Where I mean,
because
some
she's
of the stories,
a female or because?
A, because I don't believe females should ever. I think warriors should be able to protect women. Like, I think women should be protected. And if we don't have enough men to do that job, then, you know. I think there are other combat frontline jobs I don't think are best suited for women. I think
because of ability or just because of like pure physicality, guys are bigger, stronger typically.
If I got shot, I would much rather have Cole carry me out of a firefight than you carry me out of a firefight. strictly because he has more muscle.
Yeah.
And the way his body's built to tug my big ass, sorry, my 250-pound body out of a fire fight, I'd much rather have a dude do it. That's the only, that's when it comes down to a combat job. But
just
other
because
jobs,
guys are more physically naturally
yeah, just naturally, like, just like, because even if a female is, like, very physically fit and is higher end physically fit than I am, and she can run better and run farther, she might not have that pure, just sheer muscle mass to pick another guy up and pull him out of that. That's just, you know, I shouldn't say it like that. We're getting off topic.
No, that definitely makes sense.
And do you think, by the way, your view and multiple other guys' views, human nature, if your friend is shot, you react differently than a woman being shot? Because
my first thought is, where's my 45 and I'm going into the action and blocking her out of, like, I would block the woman out of the way, step between the firefight, and I would go into it and end it. Like, that's my first thought, is shoot, move, like, get out of the way, communicate, go into it, like, not run or hide. It's just supposed to go into it and make sure they're safe. And I don't think most women would think that. Some might. I know a lot of women at church that pack, and they're pretty tough.
Do you think that is your view shared by a lot of army soldiers? Or is it?
I don't know. I can't speak for anyone else. I know what I feel. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So when you were sent to Iraq, what did you do?
I was sent on what we call it Operation Friendly Skies. And our job was to go from door to door and ask politely for them not to have more than one AK-47 per household, and if they had any RPGs, that we would like them. And if they had any terrorists, that we need to talk to them.
And how did that work out?
We would come in and knock on their doors and talk to them. A lot of times we'd have tea. I ate so many dates I wanted to throw up. We met a lot of kids that needed help from the hospital, but their parents were afraid to take them in, so we had to tell their parents, take your kid in, we'll be by tomorrow. If not, we'll arrest you. A lot of burn victims. We escorted a couple school buses, cleaned some roads out, took over a couple forward operating bases, set those up, and did tactical missions from like cordon and searches to shaking hands, drinking tea. We met a lot of the head guys around there. A lot of intel collecting. I took pictures for days. I got so annoyed after a while of doing PowerPoint stuff for my lieutenant, because I had a computer and we would take pictures. I mean, I kind of liked it too. It was fun to be that guy to help him out. But we'd take pictures, grid location, name, and what they were doing, and then we'd put that into a PowerPoint of a timeline of what we did throughout the day in that mission. So you get, as the time was going, as the map, that was kind of like what I did. And yeah, there was a lot of missions we did, one time we were, this is funny, I thought grenades blew stuff up, so I have a grenade, I bite it, and I roll it under this truck, thinking it's going to blow the truck up, nothing, just boom, just makes a boom with a little bit of smoke. Then there's this door, we want to knock it down, we take a 203 round, you know, shoot it, just to see what happens. It thumps it, doesn't even knock it off its hinges. We shoot it a second time, it doesn't do anything. We go kick it. Kicking it did more than a 203 round. That's when I decided that grenades aren't like they are in movies.
Yeah.
Good time.
So was your interactions with the Iraqi population largely positive?
Yeah, I had a lot of good interactions with I think I treated them with respect, and so I had a lot of Iraqis that were maybe didn't like Americans as much, but normally they'd offer you cigarettes, you know, they'd offer you, you know, whatever they're eating, you know, some bread. They just offered. They were very friendly people, and if you were in their area, they would not keep you safe. I don't know how to describe it. They would try to protect you a little bit if you're in their village. You know, we never got a lot of ambushes, but.
Do you have any especially fond memories of Iraqi culture, like any songs that come to mind, or any food?
Dates and flatbread. I love their flatbread. They make these 50-gallon flatbread, and they make flatbread and bring out like a tray with like dates, date jam, different fruits and veggies, maybe some lamb on it or some goat. If you're really cool, they'll bring out some meat too, but if you're not, they'll bring out the veggies. And then they'll just set it up. And if like the I forgot what the name is for the guy, the dude in charge, like the mayor, like the governor, like he's like a town dude. You know what I mean? Like the older guy's like the uncle, the grandpa. He's like the chief guy. It starts with an I, I think. Not an imam. I want to say that.
An imam would be like a religious leader.
Yeah, but he's not a religious leader. He's just the tribal leader of their area. The sheik. Yeah, we'd meet with the sheiks, and that was cool. Like, they had food and music, and, I mean, they had, like, these houses had satellite TV, Mercedes Benzes, I mean, decked out, old money, regime money. And then there was the house next to it who wasn't. Fire pit, you know, still pulling a horse, you know, to do their fields, you know, not good money, like no oil money. And then there's the oil money people that are...
So you use a really interesting phrase, regime money. What do you mean by that?
I shouldn't say it like that, but from the old government, like a lot of them have like old cash, old reserves or something. I think all those people that had it back when the government was a big deal was, yeah, shouldn't ban that so much. But yeah, there was a lot of people that were with, I guess, Saddam had more money. They have bigger houses, more cars, more bullets, more... The guys that fought him were... They had barely enough food to eat. They have to farm. They have to work a lot harder. You can tell the different houses. One house will be 4,000 to 8,000 square feet in Iraq. That's huge. And then the next house will be 500, maybe 700 square feet. And it'll be, or even maybe 200 a shack, just a teeny shack with nothing, 200. And the next year there's a 4,000 square foot, like brand new house with a Mercedes out front. You're like, okay. And that's what I noticed a lot is depending on where you were at, like some people were like really, had really nice, and some people.
What did you notice about the relationship between the people that came from like old money, you call it, and the people, and their neighbors that didn't? Was there any animosity?
Not really. Everybody was pretty cool. And I think the tribes, I don't know how the tribe systems work over there, but there's definitely like the chief guy, and he's probably got a really nice place, and there's a lot of like the cousins, and it just branches out from there. The further out you are, I don't think you have as much.
Interesting. Okay.
So, earlier you mentioned dates. Mm-hmm. Can you explain more about that?
Dates? Oh, there's so many fruit dates out there. Like dates, there's in the trees, they have date trees everywhere, and these little date fruits... They turn them into jams and jellies, and you will get sick of eating these.
They're really sweet.
They will give you bags of them. Like, just, mista, just give you bags. And you're just like, and then packs of cigarettes, and you're like, I don't even smoke, but now I'm going to. I started smoking over there. It was crazy. I was so nervous, but yeah.
Dates are
fruit. Okay, I was thinking about dates as like the daughters or something.
Oh, yeah, man. A lot of dates over there. Yeah.
So,
look at her eyes. Maybe, she's tall, you know, maybe a 5'9", you know, that's all you can tell, like, you can't know. Yeah. I'm good, yeah.
So did you interact mostly with men?
Yep, never talked to the women.
Never? That's, were they the really culture. Hesitant about approaching you?
Other room.
Yeah. Did they wear the...
Burqa? Burqa, other room.
Interesting.
Never
even
talked.
Even children?
Never talked. Never said a word to a female the whole time I was there, except for maybe twice when the men were far away. And I got a glimpse of this one lady's eyes, and I saw like a greenish purple, like just blew me away. And I was like, the most beautiful Middle Eastern eyes I've ever seen. It was like, wow. And I was like, wow, I bet she's beautiful. I mean, just the eyes alone just took my breath away. Maybe I hadn't seen a woman in a long time. I was in Iraq, you know, infantry dude. But I just remember her eyes were like a purplish green, like just a whoa.
Did you say something to her?
No, not at all. Didn't want to be disrespectful.
Were you guys instructed specifically not to speak with females because it is a cultural?
Yeah, I was looking pretty mean over there. I mean, we had like our big old police mustaches on, shaved, you know, cigarette, Oakley's on, M4, looking big and mean and trying to be intimidating. Like, yeah. I don't know.
But it works, yeah. Interesting. So did you go to Iraq twice or once?
Just once.
Okay. And you were injured, correct?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So the day before Thanksgiving.
What year?
2005. We were instructed to go on a mission. We had been on mission already for 7 days. Time to go home. We already sent back half of our squad. So we were down to 13 guys, and they said, we want you to take five of those guys and an interpreter and go check out this place. And we denied it like three or four times. We said, no, don't. We're not going to do it. And they finally told us we had to do it. So we said, all right. So we went on this mission, and on that mission, it was messed up from Jump Street. Like, we were all tired. We brought them night vision goggles. It was 2:30 p.m. Of course, it's going to get dark soon. We didn't bring enough water, enough ammo. We brought all we could carry, but we didn't bring enough.
What did you expect to find?
Just that we were told to check out a graveyard, weapons cache. We got there. There was nothing there. So it was a bogus call that somebody called in hot and false information. So normally when that happens, is an ambush happens right after it. You go to the spot, nothing's there, and then you get ambushed at that spot. They're waiting. They just normally say, hey, meet us here for our ambush. And then we go in there expecting partial ambush, not all the way. But we went in there, and once we got there, nothing happened. So we decided to get out. And on the way out, nothing happened. Like, so I'm feeling weird. Like, I'm in the sixth position in the rear. I'm the one who's supposed to be in the front. Something's weird, you know, I'm starting to feel all the hairs on my neck start to stand up, and I'm like, something's wrong, not good. So I look up and I just start singing, Lord, I lift your name on high. Lord, I love to sing your praises. I'm so glad you're my life. I'm so glad you came to save us. You came from heaven to earth to show the way, from the earth to the cross, my debt you paid, from the cross to the grave, from the grave to the sky. Lord, I lift your name on high. And I sung it quietly because I didn't want to scare the other troops. And then I just started talking to God and telling him that I just wanted to be real close to him. And 6-7 minutes later, we started getting ambushed from three sides.
So in the form of just shots fired?
Shots fired. They first, like, so we're walking down this road. Or I'll just do it. So we're walking down this road this way. And I'm back here. My lieutenant's up here, Sergeant Bass, Musin, and the medic, and the interpreter, and I. The interpreter and I are talking. And I'm just kind of, and I'm walking, and all of a sudden, rounds start coming in, bam, 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 hit my lieutenant, he just drops, it hits him here, same injuries, like, he got here, and his lung, like, he got lung, shoulder, and ring finger blown off, and I think he got a couple in the chest, but it blocked those, so he fell down, and then we hit the ground, start returning fire, then we start getting fired up from the hilltop over here, the hilltop back this direction, and no fire from here. Because there's a river right here, but there's no fire right here. And there's a three-story house right there. So we're, like, going this way. And my lieutenant said, let's go this way over these hills, and we'll defend from up there, get better radio coverage. I'm like, sir, they're shooting us from there. He's like, oh. He's blood's going everywhere. And he's like, all right, well, we'll go back this way. I said, sir, they're shooting from back there. He's like, well, Abel's, make the call. I'm losing a lot of blood. I'm like, sir, let's go to this three-story house. I'm going to go clear with Sergeant Musin, and we're gonna call you in once we're up top. He said, sounds good. So me and the sergeant, we go clear the house. Don't know who kicked the door. The door flew open. We cleared that house with just pure, just went through it.
And what does it mean to clear a house?
When you clear a house, you clear it for any threats, any like, what we did is we checked all the closets, all the hiding places, and just behind the doors, and got up to the roof. Once it's an officially cleared house, like, there's nobody else in it, it's a target. You call in your men, and they know that they can go in that house and feel safe, in a way, that you've cleared that house. And when you can trust that somebody's cleared a house, it's a good feeling. You're going from outside, like, out there to safety. So they all come in, and we say, come on in.
So they're coming in as you guys are still being shot at.
No, once we're on the roof, we're taking fire from three angles, right, three different directions. We're up on top, waving them in, and saying, come on. They start coming in the house. We get everybody up to the top roof. Block the doors, like, block all the stuff on, like, we're blocking everything on the bottom, like loading, like, taking beds, couches, anything, and just pushing up against the windows and the doors. And then we go back up to the top. I'm trying to raise communications on my radio because there was a bad call that was, well, not a bad call, there was a call that was made early about going past the limit of the radio. It wasn't my call, but we went there, and we didn't have radio communications at the time. So I went up to the top, and I'm doing field expedia antennas, trying to get raised comms. And just sending out distress calls. And I guess somebody heard our distress call because another platoon of ours started coming towards the gunfire. And we were up in that three-story house for like 40 minutes shooting. I started shooting three-round bursts, four or five times, like 12, 15 rounds. My sergeant hit me on the shoulder. He said, one shot, one target. Don't mess up. You're going to run out of ammo too quick and you can't handle that. I said, all right, cool. And so I switched down to single fire. And then when one target would come up, you'd shoot it with one bullet and then go to the next target. And that, we did that for a while, and that was it. After that, we had to get out of there. Like, we didn't get radio didn't work. And my medic, he wasn't really doing much. He was just kind of hanging out. It's like, so there's only four of us really shooting. So the medic wasn't in the interpreter. So there's only four infantry guys shooting, and we're just hanging out on the roof, running low on ammo. So we decided to get out of there. And my lieutenant didn't know. He's like, what are we going to do? Can you do something? And he points at my sergeant. My sergeant's like, I will go get a truck. And I'm like, a truck, all right. He goes and he takes a truck and comes back. He comes back with a truck. He's got a pickup truck.
So he hotwires a truck, in theory.
Yeah. Oh, he did. Yeah, you can read about it in the Library of Congress. He hotwired a truck. I went down there and I helped him a little bit, but I did not even have any idea about the hotwiring situation. Like, I went downstairs. He comes, like, out of the garage with a truck. I'm like, okay. Like, I thought I was going to help you find some keys. Like, I'm looking, like, you know what I mean? You're looking for keys. No, he's like... pulls it out to the front, and then he's like, come on in. And so we all just go out, you know, get in, and I get in the front seat, and in the front right seat. Sergeant Bass pulls me out of there. He says, no, I'm gonna sit there, and puts me in the back seat. And so we haul down the road, and we were going like 40-50 kilometers an hour, and then we got ambushed again
by another group or that. Mm-hmm.
And the guys in the front seat both got killed. So I would have been in the front seat, but he told me to get in the back. And I had survivor guilt for a long time on that, but I think God puts everybody in time and a place, and so I'm cool with that now. But it's pretty hard because he just got married. And yeah. I'm going to go see his grave this year sometime. It's in D.C.
So were you in the car when you got shot? Or
yeah, I was in the back of the truck, and we were all just hauling down the road, and then we'd gone down, like, we got back on this road that we were walking down,
yeah.
We went, like, we were going down, made it, like, 3 kilometers down the road, and then we got ambushed again, and we were...
This is the third time you've been ambushed in one night.
Well, like, on the ground, and then we stayed in the house, then got in it again, and then took off, and then, okay. Yeah, so maybe kind of two, maybe three interactions, okay. And then, down there when we got hit again, they were on the side. There was two guys over here, and when I saw the two guys stand up, I actually dropped both, like, I shot both of those guys, but I didn't see the other dudes, and they had a weapon mounted machine gun, and that one tore into the truck. And by that time the other platoon was getting close, and so a couple minutes later they showed up. But after I first got shot, the rounds came and hit my arm here, like hit my shoulder, this and this, like they hit all this, pulled my head down, and then two off my helmet. I still have my helmet, like two rounds skipped off it.
So you had 4 shots hit your right arm?
Yeah, four 7.62 rounds hit my right arm.
From the shoulder all the way down to your wrist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it took off my middle finger. Well, not took it off, but it damaged it. Went through my wrist. And so that happened, and I'm laying on my back thinking, I ain't gonna die in this foreign country. No, I'm not. My job is not to lay here. And I try to, I'm like, my job is to find my man, my lieutenant, and keep fighting. Like, wherever he's at, I'll be next to him. And it was a cool feeling. I tried to stand up with his hand, and it didn't work. And so I, like, grab my rifle with my other hand, stand up, and I'm holding, like, a 9mm. He doesn't weigh anything. And I end up getting over to him, and then we're kind of, like, back-to-back, kind of hanging out, doing, like, tourniquets on each other.
It's a lot.
Yeah. And then at that time, I heard Americans, like, they were saying stuff. And then, like, the other medics, like, cause it had been, like, 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And they showed up, and they were like, you can relax. We got you. And we got security.
It's that safety you were talking about. You can trust your soldiers.
And then I checked to make sure I had all my appendages. I had everything. I was very happy about that. And then... they asked me if they could get me anything. I asked for some morphine. They said I lost a little too much blood. Can't give you any of your heartless, you know. So, all right. And then I'm waiting there, and all of a sudden I feel this, like, I went from, like, literally thinking I was going to die in this country to feeling like I could hear the helicopters feel the rotor wash on my, and again, like, all my hair stood up, and at that point I knew I wasn't going to die in a foreign country, which is pretty cool. I knew I'd see my family again, like, all this stuff kind of all came at once. And And then, yeah, I got on the bird, and my lieutenant's like, they made me spit out my chew. I need it. And so I was like, all right, I need to get some Levi Garrett. So I pulled out a big bag of Red Man or something and gave it to him. He put the whole thing in and started passing out. And I kept having to wake up in and out of consciousness with my good arm. He lost a lot of blood, too. Uh-huh. That was a fun ride on a helicopter.
Yeah, and so from there, did you go straight to Germany?
We went to the biop, not hotel, the hospital.
Okay. And so how long were you there before you left for?
18 to 36 hours. We got some stale turkey sandwiches for Thanksgiving, because that was Thanksgiving Day, 05.
Did you get minor medical treatment while you were there?
Yeah, I don't know. They just did stabilization. And then we got actual treatment when we went. They might have washed out some stuff, but probably not. They probably just bandaged it. Yeah. Tried to pull out some big chunks. And then when we got up there to Landstuhl, Germany, I actually got to hang out there for 72 hours, and they did a little bit of stuff, but not many, and no real surgery, so I got to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And I met Ron White while I was over in Landstuhl. He came in with a little sippy cup and sucking on a cigar.
You know that's not water in that cup.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was asking about my pain meds, and I was like, no, no.
See, so before like, that, you know who he is.
Sauce, huh? He's just sipping. Oh, yeah, I love him. Yeah, he's... Tater salad. Yeah, he came in and just started dropping jokes. I'm just cracking up. Like, I mean, I got my catheter and I'm almost trying to pee my pants, but I can't.
Yeah. You know who Ron White is?
No.
Oh.
Who is he?
Google him.
Okay.
He's a comedian.
Yeah, he's a southern comedian. This is great.
He's pro, you know, soldiers. He loves them. But his jokes are priceless. But he's a hick. He smokes. He drinks whiskey. Does everything.
Okay.
Man's man type of thing.
Okay. Yeah, so you were in D.C. for a month, getting some treatment. And then, I remember you saying that you had about a year and a half left?
Yeah, just one second. Okay. Okay, so what was that?
So you're in D.C. for about a month. And then I remember you saying that you only had about a month or a year and a half left.
After they did the D.C. tree lighting, they wanted to send all the soldiers who could walk, wheelchair, anything, home to their families by Christmas morning. And so they loaded like 30 of us onto the C-17. I mean, the most ragtag group of soldiers you've seen. People probably just dripping blood. Like, it was good, though. But, like, we all get on the bird, and they take us all the way, and we made stops everywhere. Like, all the big cities, and drop people off at their homes. And I got home at midnight, or 12:30 Christmas morning, like that morning, and my dad came down to San Antonio to pick me up and drove me to Austin, and I was home for Christmas. Yeah, and I woke up, and it was funny, my baby sister, Jolene, who was, you know, she had just broken her the same arm, and so she had a pink cast, and I had a big, big army cast on, and she had a little beanbag pillow she got for me, just so, like a bean, so I could have it sit there and not hurt.
Yeah?
Yeah. And she was like, I think, 5 or 6 at the time. Now she's like 12. But, yeah.
But your mom was freaking out.
Yeah, my mom was freaking out. She actually really freaked out. She pulled the pin out of my... I don't have my middle finger anymore, so it didn't hurt, Mom. You're good. But, like, she hugged me. I had a pin, like, a pin this long in my finger.
It's like, what, 3 or 4 inches?
Yeah, all the way in there. And what happens is I hug her, and she's got a knit sweater on. The pin's got a hook on it, and it grabs the knit and just pulls it right out. And I'm like, oh. And it's just hanging. I pulled off her sweater, and I just do this.
You just put the pin back in your
finger. Stopped about halfway, and so I had to bend it around and then just stick it back in the rest of the way. That's how much morphine I was on. I was on like 300 milligrams a day, just drooling in my soup. The military had me not feeling anything for like a year and a half.
Oh my God. What was that Christmas like?
She's in the next Thanksgiving. It was a good Christmas, though.
Oh,
good family Christmas.
Good. So what did you do after that? You have a year or so left.
Yep. I had my 21st birthday right after that. Turned 21. I wasn't even 21 yet in Iraq. I wasn't even 21 yet when I went to Iraq. So I had my 21st birthday. I went out and had one drink with my brother. And that was it. Just one drink. I felt sick. I was like, I can't drink.
You were still on morphine, right?
Yeah, I just had one drink and I felt sick, and it was like, so I hung out with him for a while, then my fiance got back with her, got married, fell in love, and then got divorced 7 months later. When she found out about BAH, yeah, I wasn't giving it to her. I wasn't giving her that money, and she got mad at me and divorced me for it. And cheated on me multiple times. So.
And you knew her before you joined the military?
No, I met her at church while I was in the military.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Anyways, so after that divorce, you know, I did my therapy. Then November, started getting ready to get out of the military of 07. They kept me in a long time because of my arm, and I did like 7 major surgeries and like 4 or 5 small surgeries, like washouts and stuff, and then washouts in between. So I've had like 12 or 13 surgeries, 11 surgeries, and then a couple small washouts in between. And then I did the surgeries, then got out of the military. They retired me out of the military. Medically retired because of my gunshot wounds. And before PTSD, they didn't talk about that. So I was out, you know. And I got, just for my injuries alone, they hooked me up with school and some money. And I got off my morphine, moved up to Oregon. And that was one of the conditions. Texas doctors just want to give you morphine, but up here, natural doctors, they're like, you should go exercise. They give you like back massage. You can go get all these other things you can do up here. They're natural, as opposed to Texas, where you can't, and they just want to give you morphine and Oxycontin and Xanax. And I don't need to be on that stuff. So
not good for you.
I was 315 pounds in Texas. I weigh 245 right now, and I go to the gym every other day. I would never do that in Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah, like comparatively, like I'm a lot healthier up here and now than when I first got out of the military.
And now you're going to school at George Fox.
Yep, George Fox.
Using the GI Bill.
Yep, got on the dean's list last semester. And
what are you majoring in?
I'm majoring in biblical studies and counseling.
And what do you hope to do after you graduate?
Work with veterans with PTSD, and if I can't work at the VA straight up, then I want to be either like an on-call chaplain at a hospital or something, or I can be just the guy you call and I'll be on the other. Yeah, hi, he's gone. Or the guy you come into an office and get to talk to. I want to be able to put my Purple Heart on the wall and my combat record and just say, hey, I may not have been there for a long time, but you can come talk to me about what you saw.
Definitely.
Well. Thank you so much for your time and your willingness to share your story. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for your service.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.